That's very important. And bond yields represent the real cost of debt. So rising yields in a debt crisis are very dangerous signs. And yields rise when trust and demand, and therefore price, when trust and demand tank, the price in bonds tanks as well, and the yields rise. And what we're seeing right now is evidence of this debt crisis, to answer your question, is that yields on government bonds or government IOUs are the highest in decades. That's not just the World Reserve Currency or the 10-year US Treasury. That's the UK gilt, the German Bund, the Japanese JGB, France, Canada. All of these sovereign bonds are having massive spikes in their yields because there's a massive distrust in their bonds. And there's a massive distrust in their bonds because global debt's at 360 trillion, US public debt, government debt's at nearly 40 trillion. So we're a bad credit. We're just a bad credit. It's very bad math. Investors expect a higher premium, just like a bad credit has to pay higher rates for a car loan. The world wants higher rates for our junky, unloved, distrusted, over-indebted US IOU. And in addition, there are more sellers now than buyers of US Treasuries.
Good day, everybody. It's me, just Steve Yang here, Natural Resource Stocks, where we mine for stories that matter. And today I'm thrilled to have with me Matthew Pijpenberg, partner at Von Grayers Gold, based out of Zurich, Switzerland. Matthew's also a published author and a respected voice in our space. Matthew, it's great to have you on. How are you today?
I'm great, Stephen. Thanks for inviting me. I look forward to it.
Absolutely. Matthew, I want to talk about, what some people call a Ponzi scheme in the financial system. It's, some describe it as Ponzi-like in structure. Do you think that's fair? And how close are we to a real debt crisis in the US?
That's not entirely unfair. You're basically referring to the Federal Reserve and this philosophy behind it, really more recently modern monetary theory, which I love, is this notion that you can solve a debt crisis by issuing more debt and then paying for that debt with money mouse clicked out of the Eccles building. To me, that sounds too good to be true. And it is. Modern monetary theory is really neither modern nor really monetary, and not even a theory. It's been tried and tested and failed for millennia, from ancient Rome to 18th century France to the John Law era to Yugoslavia in the 90s to Weimar Germany, et cetera, to today at the ECB, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, and of course, the Fed. And they're all pretending that this is a deficit without tears, that you can monetize debt with mouse click money, what we'll call money printing. It's literally just adding a zero whenever necessary to pay down debt. That expands credit and that expands the money supply indirectly. MO at the Fed and M2, the fancy lads call it in the street. But of course, it's just adding water to a glass of wine and diluting the value of that wine, and it's diluting the purchasing power of the dollar. And so technically, you can have deficits without tears by printing money to cover grotesque overspending and grotesque mismanagement of our monetary system by debasing the currency. But it's a lose-lose scenario because all you're getting is an artificially sustained asset bubble and the debasement of the currency. And there's, to me, that is kind of a Ponzi scheme. You just keep faking it until you make it, but you never really make it because you're debasing the currency. With a Ponzi scheme, you're just shuffling money around and hoping nobody calls or does a run on the bank. With the Federal Reserve or the central bank modern monetary theory system, you just keep printing money or expanding the money supply to debase the currency. But the net result is what Hemingway called the permanent ruin of currency debasement and war, which is where we find ourselves today. But, kind of, I think of another famous American author dear to me, Mark Twain. He said, I sometimes wonder if the world is run by smart people putting us on or by imbeciles who really mean it. And when I think about the Federal Reserve for so many reasons, it is imbecility. And I look at our current system of debt imbecility. In 1980, the US was running 25% debt to GDP, and fast forward today, it's 120%. Right around the time I was born in the early 70s, US debt was 248 billion. Now we're nearing 40 trillion. We're past 39 trillion. So that's just imbecile levels of debt. But I think even more, and I'll finish here with my first point, is there's an imbecility of truth. There's a lack of honest transparency, left or right, at the White House, at the Parliament, at the Congress, at the National Assembly, at the bureaucracy in Brussels. I mean, there's so many examples of just flagrant dishonesty to cover really, really bad math. You could list the transitory inflation meme we saw under Powell, the trimmed mean PCE that we're going to have under Warsh, the non-recession recession that we've been having for 3 or 4 years, the non-QE, the misreported inflation, grotesquely misreported. This idea that DOGE spending cuts will save us, that the US aid will save us, that tariffs will save us, that stablecoin will save us, or Bitcoin's strategic reserve will save us. These are all, to me, imbecilic dishonesties, desperate dishonesties to hide a really grotesque mathematical reality that our debt is just too high. So I don't think these are mistakes. I think they're flagrant lies. And there was an economist in the 1970s that no one remembers, this guy named Charles Goodhart. He did some deep, deep dives on political math whenever they were making inflation targets or growth targets or employment targets. He pretty much empirically showed that the numbers were complete fiction. So 2 + 2 = 1 over and over. So yeah, I think it's a Ponzi scheme in an indirect way, Steve. It's a long answer to a short question.
So, why does the Keynesian economics, why does the modern monetary theory still hold, still operate if it's unattainable?
Well, it's a great question too. I think in simplest terms, Keynesian theory is the idea that debt can be helpful. And actually, debt, anyone who has a mortgage at a low rate or a fixed rate, debt can be helpful. It gives you the time value of money. You can spread out payments. I'm simplifying, but Keynes was in favor of using debt for growth. That's fine until the debt goes from incremental to exponential, or from feasible to stupid to unsustainable to impossible. And the Keynesian model is the model the West uses. I mean, I say the West, I'm saying the USA, from college economics to graduate school programs. The Keynesian model is the model for tenure. It's the model for PhD theses. It's the model for duping the American population into thinking that debt is good. What is missing, and what I've found as an American European, half German, half American, living overseas. I studied mostly in the States. I worked obviously half of my life in Europe, but I do know from my kids and my colleagues, and from even my own academic background, that the Austrian school of economics, which is far more blunt and honest about death, this is von Mises and Schumpeter and these others. This idea that if you get debt to a certain point, it actually destroys growth and leads to currency debasement. That was something Sir Thomas Gresham knew in the 1550s, that David Hume knew in the 1750s, and that Ernest Hemingway knew. But I'm saying the Austrian school, which says at a certain point, debt becomes destructive, and after a certain debt to GDP ratio, growth becomes mathematically impossible, and that the only way to sustain your debt is at the expense of the currency. That is very understood by the Austrian school. It is completely not only misunderstood, it's deliberately ignored in the US academic system. You could go to Harvard down from New Hampshire and go into their MBA programs and ask them to distinguish Keynesian economics from the Austrian school. I would bet you the vast majority couldn't, because we're not trained to think that way. And Europe and history are far more nuanced in Europe, because it's just an older country than the US. But they've seen debt cycles, the likes of which Americans have not seen, but are going to experience and are experiencing right now. And I say that as a patriot, not as an anti-American. But we are about to have an Austrian school moment. We're literally living in one right now because of our debt. And we're going to learn the real pain of currency debasement, and real inflation, not misreported, fictitious inflation, which is what we see really since the Fed came into fruition in 1913.
So when you say that we're about to see what the debt cycle fully looks like, I mean, how close are we to a debt crisis or a collapse, or where are you starting to see the biggest cracks?
Well, I think we've been in one for years. I think we've been in one really since 2014 when the central banks of the world started net dumping US treasuries, which are US IOUs, and net stacking physical gold. That trajectory really began when we promised that quantitative easing or money printing post the GFC or the Great Crisis in 2008. Bernanke said that we would have some temporary quantitative easing, which I guess is another euphemism for mouse click money. When that QE temporary problem was not solved, in other words, QE was not temporary, it then became QE2, QE3, QE4, Operation Twist, unlimited QE. When it became clear by 2014 that Bernanke's temporary transitory solution was now a full-on addiction to easy money created by a mouse clicker at the Eccles Building, the world started to look differently at US Treasuries and the IOUs of Uncle Sam. That started in 2014. It became exponential in 2022 under the Biden administration when we weaponized the world reserve currency against a major nuclear power like Russia and froze the FX reserves, took them off the SWIFT system, et cetera. When we weaponized the dollar, again, whatever you think of Putin and Zelensky and the war and the sanctions, the rest of the world started looking at the US dollar, the US Treasury very, very differently. It's like if you wrote an article and I was a banker at Citibank and I seized your account, you wouldn't recommend Citibank to your friends. When the US froze the FX reserve of a major power like Russia, the world in general, friend or enemy of America, started to distrust that dollar and distrust that government and that IOU. And that's when the whole de-dollarization meme started to kick in. That's when the BRICS started to rise and look for trade settlements outside of the dollar and net settling in gold. That's when central banks began stacking gold and dumping US treasuries at an unprecedented level. Gold stacking by central banks since 2022 has increased by 5x. They don't trust a dollar in a treasury that's so indebted, and they really don't trust one that's now weaponized. And so it's no coincidence, as I wrote in 2022, that this was a watershed moment and that the dollar would continue to be debased, distrusted, and unloved, and that gold would hit new all-time highs. And of course, within 3 years, it was at 5,500. It's going to go much, much higher. We can talk about that too. But that was the first sign, I think, really, that we were in a debt crisis because no one was buying our debt. When you fast forward to today, Steve, I mean, the bond market is boring, but it is the basis of all markets. Everyone talks about the stock market, and the global stock market is 126 trillion, but the global bond market is actually much bigger. It's 145 trillion. And it's a boring thing to talk about, but for your listeners who don't know this, many already do maybe, but the most important thing in the bond market, and I've said this for years and I'm not alone, is that yields matter. And bond yields rise when bond prices fall. That's very important. And bond yields represent the real cost of debt. So rising yields in a debt crisis are very dangerous signs. And yields rise when trust in demand and therefore price, when trust and demand tank, the price in bonds tanks as well, and the yields rise. And what we're seeing right now is evidence of this debt crisis, to answer your question, is that yields on government bonds or government IOUs are the highest in decades. That's not just the World Reserve Currency or the 10-year US Treasury, that's the UK gilt, the German Bund, the Japanese JGB, France, Canada. All of these sovereign bonds are having massive spikes in their yields because there's a massive distrust in their bonds. And there's a massive distrust in their bonds because global debt's at 360 trillion, US public debt, government debt's at nearly 40 trillion. So we're a bad credit. We're just a bad credit. It's very bad math. Investors expect a higher premium, just like a bad credit has to pay higher rates for a car loan. The world wants higher rates for our junky, unloved, distrusted, over-indebted US IOU. And in addition, there are more sellers now than buyers of US Treasuries. And that's a big problem for America because We're running 7% current account deficits. We have massive debt. We don't have the income or the tax receipts to pay our deficits. So we fill that gap with money created out of thin air. That debases the money, and that's what's going to send gold to record highs over the next 5 years. But that's a debt crisis.
So I remember being in grade school, we've been talking about how the US has been in debt. Even back then, there was some sort of acknowledgement that there's no way we're paying this back. So, and you talk about, adding zeros here or there, is there, you talked about the weaponization of the dollar, but is are people, for whatever reason, getting more awakened to this issue, and is that what's primarily driving the gold price? And then what are people not understanding about what debasement of the currency looks like for them now and in the future?
Right now, what's driving the gold price, and I hate to say because I'm no fan of central banks anywhere, including the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, which I drive by all the time. But you got to look at what they're doing, not what they're saying. And what they're doing is stacking gold because they don't trust paper money. And they've been doing this for a while. Sadly, the retail man on the street is usually the last to get the memo. And that's not only that's not only typical, that's deliberate. The world and the central banks and the banking system and the monetary system doesn't want citizens, at least in the West, to understand gold. And I think it's been very deliberate. But I was talking to my partner, Johnny Haycock, like me, 30 plus years in Wall Street. He was based out of London, worked at Salomon Brothers, managing director of Morgan Stanley. And he and I were talking this morning about how few people, even at the most quote unquote sophisticated level, really understand the debasement trade or what's happening to paper currencies in this debt environment. So it's not an elitist thing to say that the masses don't understand gold or currency debasement. Very few people do because it actually isn't that complicated, but it's not taught in economics, it's not taught in civics, it's not discussed on CNN, it's not brought up on a 60 Minutes special, it's not certainly talked about by our Fed chairman or our Misfit Island of Misfit Toys representatives in the House or the Senate. They have a junior high level understanding of economics. So it's not only misunderstood, it's ignorant, but I think it's deliberately misunderstood and not pushed in schools because the more people that understood it, as Henry Ford said, if they understood banking, there'd be pitchforks in the street. If people took the time to understand how currencies are always debased to pay back debt, which to your point will never be repaid. Can never be repaid. You can only debase the currency and run inflation really hot to pay down that debt and then lie about the inflation. But what is encouraging, whatever we think of the new media, I've written years ago that in the 1980s, there were 50 companies, media outlets in the US that disseminated information. By 2026, there are basically five that run 99% of the data or the information that we see. Most of those platforms are run by big tech. They're highly political. They're completely dishonest, and they pick and choose what's important to talk about. They're very divisive. Again, left or right. I think what's really exciting about alternative media, the good, the bad, and the ugly, there are good platforms out there like yours with, guests that I think are more credible. You have to choose and pick your own informants or what you think where you get your information from. We all have to do that. I think there's a number of really good figures out there and good platforms that individual by individual, hour by hour, click by click, minute by minute, are telling a more believable narrative, not just a gloom and doom narrative, but a more believable narrative about the debasement of the currency to get our governments out of debt at the expense of the man on the street. Again, this is math. It's not gloom and doom. It's not gold bug selling your own book. There are honest fiduciaries in the commodity space, in the risk asset space, Jeffrey Gundlach in the bond space, Jeremy Grantham in the equity space, Ray Dalio, Michael Burry, certainly in the precious metal space, Egon von Greyers, myself, Luke Roman. There are a lot of people talking about this enough that bit by bit, slow drip by slow drip, people are starting to understand currency debasement. And frankly, even if they don't understand it, and it's not that hard to figure out, they're feeling it. They certainly feel that inflation is a lot higher than it's reported. And you can have different views on the war, you can have different views on immigration, you can have different views on left versus right, but all of us see the toll on the GW Bridge or the price of gas or the cost of education or medical expenses or educational expenses. And we all know that's getting much, much higher than 3.8% CPI inflation. So you feel it first. And then if you're curious, you need to pick your advisors, so to speak. You have to go out and do the homework. It doesn't require an MBA. It doesn't require 4 years at a fancy school undergrad. It just requires curiosity and being informed more than being emotional. And it ultimately comes down to this: when debt gets too high, it can't be repaid. And the only way to repay it is to inflate it away by destroying the currency that your listeners measure their wealth with, which is paper money. And this is nothing new. In millennia, it always happens in cycles, usually 250-year cycles, which is exactly where America finds itself. And it's important that people get informed, not so they can become a client of mine in Zurich. Our minimums are very high, but they can get informed by what we're talking about and try to protect themselves from the invisible theft, which is really open robbery of their wealth. It's compounding at a rate far higher than the CPI inflation scale. Saving in a checking account or a savings account, to the extent you can save anything, is just being stolen from you every day by the invisible tax of misreported inflation. And that's not fable, but fact, Steve.
Matthew, you
Matthew.
mentioned before inflation reported versus actual. What's the difference and why is there a discrepancy?
Well, again, this is nothing new. The difference is extraordinary. There's guys like John Williams at ShadowStats. The scale used to measure inflation from the 1980s or even the 70s under the 80s and the Volcker era, that CPI scale has been tweaked, I think, 22 times since then. And when I say tweaked, it's just been manipulated to downplay what is the actual inflation. When we talk about 3.8, which is still pretty bad, 3.8 consumer inflation. If you look at the same scale used to measure inflation that Volcker used, that would be closer to 12 to 13% today. And if you have 13% inflation, that just means you're losing 13% of purchasing power because things cost 13% more. The compounding effect of that year after year adds up real fast, which is why everything feels more expensive. But 13% inflation would be incredibly embarrassing to anyone running for office today. And it would certainly be a sign of the failure of central bank monetary policy. It would be an open signal that our monetary policy has failed, that all this money printing and mouse clicking, quantitative easing, this euphemism, has been a disaster. So, of course, what do you do? What did Charles Goodhart said, or what did the former head of the European Commission here? I forgot his name. Some Juncker, Claude Juncker. When the information is really bad, we just lie. And I'm going to say it right out. The inflation scale, the CPI scale that we use to measure inflation is an open lie. It's a deliberate lie because it's political suicide to admit the failure of our monetary policies, which is robbing you as we speak. But even the official numbers, Steve, of CPI is at 3.8, which is not even close to the target 2%. Which they haven't been able to, CPI is the cost of consumer goods. It's rising at 3.8. It's actually four times that much, but even the official number is pretty bad. And the PPI, which is the cost of making things, is at 6%. So it's rising steadily again. Even the dishonest official numbers are startling. But what's, I think, fascinating, what people certainly can understand, because there is this disconnect, certainly since the conflict in Iran, and since the Strait of Hormuz was closed, fertilizer's up 20%, diesel fuel's up 50%, gasoline's up 52%, European natural gas on my side of the Atlantic is up 54%, jet fuel's up 58%, and WTI crude oil is up 60%. So if all these major things are up double digits at high percentage points, how can the U.S. CPI be at 3.8%. And it's fascinating. But what we're going to see, and I'm not alone in this, is in particular the lag effect of $100 oil per barrel oil. If this conflict, which was supposed to be over 2 months ago, continues, what we're going to see is rising rates, rising oil prices, And the lag effect of that, ironically, that fertilizer inflation at 20%, which no one talks about, we're going to start to see that about 2 or 3 months out at much, much higher prices on Main Street. Even here in Europe, where I am, there are literally less things on the shelves. Things cost more. Gas stations have X amount of liter cap of gas you can buy. The U.S. has its own oil. That's fine, but that doesn't prevent the U.S. from having massive second derivative, third ripple effect derivatives in the inflation of everything else that gets delivered to the U.S. on ships that need oil. So this isn't just a guesstimation, it's just the consequence of these price hikes. So this conflict in Iran is much more than just a political crisis. It's going to spur an already grotesque inflationary problem in the U.S., in my opinion. Again, I'm not alone in that. It doesn't take much to break a system. When we had the subprime crisis in 2008, everyone was talking about mortgages failing all over. Actually, it really was only 13% of the subprime market that defaulted. And it was only 5% of overall mortgages that defaulted. It didn't take much to send that banking crisis into a real uh-oh moment. And I think this inflation on Main Street and the private credit risks on Wall Street could put us into a real severe uh-oh moment. But that's a conversation about the stock market. But getting back to inflation, it's completely grotesquely dishonestly reported. Everyone on Wall Street knows that. It's only going to get worse, not better. Actually, the US government wants higher inflation to have inflation to inflate away debt. Inflation is really good when you're the debt door with debased money. They just misreport it so they don't have to have the political optics of it or admit to the failure of their financial system since 1913.
Matthew, I want to, we talked about inflation, we talked about reported actual, we talked about the goal of 2% or whatever, and who's going to come to the rescue, and makes me wonder about the Federal Reserve. Is, it's been called the lender of last resort, but does that still hold as an accurate description? Is it stabilizing the system or adding to its problem? And looking ahead, what's its future? Does it evolve or does it eventually dissolve, or what's the future for the Federal Reserve?
Thomas Jefferson, one of our founding fathers, said, "I fear a central bank on our shores more than I fear a standing army from a foreign country on our shores." And Andrew Jackson, obviously, now when everyone's a big fan of Andrew Jackson, he's very blunt and politically incorrect in so many ways, but he said, "A central bank is the prostitution of our monetary system for the benefit of the few at the expense of the many." This was the 1700s and 1800s. They were horrifically aghast by the very notion of a central bank that could control the price and supply of US money. And even Woodrow Wilson, who signed the Federal Reserve Act in 1913, right before Christmas, when half of Congress was out of there, said it was the darkest day of his life and the darkest day for our nation. So I'm not alone in saying I think one of the worst moments in our history was when the Federal Reserve, this cabal of bankers, and there's a great book, of course, The Creature from Jekyll Island, that really brings this
Great
out in
book.
full force. Everyone, if they read nothing else, could read that. In my opinion, the central banks couldn't be lower. They have not prevented market booms and busts. They have never called a recession correctly in the last 15 recessions. Again, since 1913, they've done nothing to protect us from boom and bust cycles that they themselves create. There are a few guys like Thomas Hernig, their FOMC presidents or members, that I think were pretty ethical. They're a minority. Most central bankers and FOMC members are mavens to a system. It's for career enhancement, and it's to follow a party line, basically, that you can dial up inflation or deflation with the interest rate or money supply expansion. But they don't think longer term. They are a moral hazard because every time our country goes into debt, they just create money out of nowhere to monetize that debt. That's ultimately destructive of everything. It destroys the bond market because bond yields are controlled by the Fed, not by natural supply and demand. When interest rates are controlled by the Fed, that makes stock bubbles get bigger than they should. They go past all, normal valuations, and it debases the currency. So I think they're the patient zero of sound economics because it's like always getting It's like always getting an antibiotic when you're sick. That works for a while until you destroy your immune system. When you consistently bail out broken systems with mouse click dollars, fake money, you destroy the immune system of capitalism. We don't have capitalism. We have a central bank driven stock market. We have no price discovery anymore. We have Fed is either risk on or risk off. So the Fed is an absolute disaster. And the more you study it, the more you'll realize what I'm saying isn't an exaggeration. The Fed can keep kicking the can and postponing market crashes, and can keep postponing deficit crises, because we can all, like, if you and I had a money printer in our basement that we could legally use every time we had a mortgage or a tuition payment or a big bill to pay, of course, who wouldn't be seduced to use that? Who wouldn't become addicted to that? But it's really just counterfeit. If you did that at a national scale, though, you're going to destroy the currency. And that's where we're at right now. We are now at a point where our currency will be debased to save our bond market. There's no one who's going to save us. Kevin Warsh is not going to save us. He calls it the new regime change. That's absolutely, as usual, classic, par for the course dishonesty from our central bankers. I'm sorry, but all Kevin Warsh's regime change is to continue to let inflation run higher than the yield on the 10-year treasury to inflate away debt. And the way he's basically confessed this, Steve, he calls it is changing the measure of inflation. He's changed PCE inflation to what he calls trimmed mean PCE, which is just a euphemism for trimming of the truth. If oil gets higher than $100 a barrel, he'll just change the measure of how we put oil in the inflation scale. Again, it's saying the quiet part out loud. We're going to let inflation rip. We're just not going to report it accurately. And that's what they did with the CPI. I've written about this for years. John Williams understands this. Shadow Stats understands this. Wall Street understands this. So we'll just lie about inflation. But what that means for your listeners is, again, do your own research, but you're losing purchasing power as we're speaking. Your dollar buys you less. If you're lucky enough to earn enough dollars to get through the year, it's still buying you less. If you measure the return of your dollars in the stock market or a 401k, it will buy you less. God forbid, if you're saving in a savings account, you're literally losing money because your currency is like an ice cube that is melting under the weight of 40 trillion in public debt. And it will simply buy you less in 5 minutes and in 5 years than it did yesterday and today. And again, if you study this and you look at this, this is not exaggeration. It's quantifiable truth. So again, it's that's the dishonesty and the gaslighting that's going on by our DC experts, who are just, like I said, the island of misfit toys, who are really good at promulgating fancy phrases and terminology to hide terrible, terrible math.
Matthew, what stands out to you about how central banks and governments have been behaving in recent years, especially around gold, CBDCs, Bitcoin, and what does that tell us?
Yeah, I mean, again, for those who are holding Bitcoin, I'm neither pro or anti-Bitcoin. I'm fairly Swiss neutral on it. I'm no horse in that race. I am obviously an anti-fiat money proponent, and I think the Bitcoin camp has really jumped onto that narrative. One of the things I like about the Bitcoin narrative is it got a lot of a younger generation to look at currency debasement, the debasement of the dollar, the corruption of government money, and they were looking for a decentralized asset like Bitcoin. And I like the fact that at least the Bitcoin debate or the Bitcoin narrative, and certainly the Bitcoin bull market, got more and more people thinking about currency debasement and an anti-fiat money solution to the problems that we've been talking about. Is Bitcoin truly an anti-fiat solution, or is it just a bubble or a mania, as Charles Mackay or John Hussman would say? Most people are highly polarized in that debate. They say Bitcoin can go to zero, and it will. And it doesn't matter what it does in the short term. You got Peter Schiff on that camp and others. I'm not that violently interested either way. I do think I have a lot of questions about Bitcoin. Oh, who really created it? Was it Langley, or was it some guy in Asia? Was it some code writer? Was it some blockchain genius? And what were their longer term motives? What I can also say is it's no longer a decentralized asset. It's a very politicized asset. It's no fault of blockchain or Bitcoin or Sam Bankman-Fried. That wasn't a failure of Bitcoin. That was a failure of an exchange. So the headlines that have kind of hurt Bitcoin are very nuanced. But what bothered me in 2024, 2025, with the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve Act and the issuance of stable coins, which are not just Bitcoin, stable coins are very different. What the administration is doing is very similar to what they did in the 1970s with oil. They have a reserve of Bitcoin. They want to pump up the price of Bitcoin to pay down some debt, which is what El Salvador did. You know, Bitcoin wasn't used as a medium of exchange anywhere in El Salvador, but it was a pumped up asset that they used to pay down debt. God bless El Salvador. A very desperate USA tried to do that with Bitcoin as well, and that's to be determined. The jury's out. I don't think it's going to solve our debt crisis. But what stablecoin is far more nefarious, far more devious, far more brilliant, is the new oil. Again, we tried to pump up oil in the 1970s to pay down our post-Vietnam debt. The idea that stablecoin, which is nothing more than an e-dollar that gives you no yield, you give your dollar to Circle Internet or Tether or JP Morgan. JP Morgan gives you an e-dollar back. They take your dollar and they invest it in US Treasuries. By law, they get a yield. They get a big fat profit. You get a programmable, trackable, and seizable dollar, which is really central bank digital currency issued by private banks and private internet tech companies, not the Fed, but it's the same thing. And what's even more disgusting is that Tether and Circle Internet, they take the profits they make on these yields that you're not getting, and they invest in physical gold because they don't even trust the dollar, whether it's a paper dollar or an e-dollar. They're buying gold with it. I think that says a lot. But what's dangerous about stablecoins as a desperate attempt to try and create more demand for an unloved dollar and an unloved US Treasury is it's very programmable and trackable. And it means it's also very controllable. And that is the centralization theme that always comes in the wake of desperate, broke countries like the US. Even though relative to others, we may seem strong, we have the balance sheet of a banana republic, and we are in a position, not the end of America, not the end of the world reserve currency, but in the weakest position financially we've been in our history. And so that requires more control and more division on Main Street and more control from the top down. And that's exactly what stablecoin is. It's a control mechanism. And it's an attempt to sponge up unloved dollars and unloved US treasuries. To me, it's far too little too late, very desperate, very dishonest, and very dangerous.
You said stablecoin is very nefarious. It's a quite a misnomer. It's makes it's good branding at the very least.
Not stable. It's not even a coin. It's a classic.
Bitcoin has been deemed as, you know, digital scarcity, or some would say digital gold. It doesn't seem to operate as money, number one, and two, it seems more like a speculative asset. And we talked about stablecoin and what the government's trying to do and all that stuff. Does it inevitably get absorbed into the, you know, the traditional financial system it claims to sit outside of?
Well, if you ask the Bitcoin camp, they're saying they're in a consolidation period right now. You know, they only started what in 2009. Give us time. We're going to be a medium of exchange. We're going to be a unit of account. We're going to be a store of value. And that's the definition of, you know, money, a medium of exchange, a unit of account, and a store of value. Okay, if you break that down in current practice, they're none of those things really. And that's not just being anti-Bitcoin. It's not really used to buy or sell groceries, cars, central bank balance sheets. And I would say gold is very different, and we'll distinguish that from Bitcoin. So it's not really a medium of exchange. To the extent that it is, most of it, or not most of it, a lot of it is done, at least in the past, for illegal practices. And you know, a lot of people bring that out. And again, I don't have the data to confirm or deny that, but I certainly know there's a great deal of dark activity in the shadow system that is Bitcoin. But it's really not a normal medium of exchange that you use on a daily basis. It's not a store of value because the standard deviation is all over the place. It can go from 100,000 to 70,000 to 60,000 in a Twitter cycle. That doesn't make it a stable store of value. So again, is it money now? No. The Bitcoin camp will argue eventually it will be. They'll cite the examples of El Salvador where it helped save El Salvador. They'll cite the example of Iran when they were trying to create a toll for the Strait of Hormuz. You could pay in Bitcoin, not US dollars. But again, Iran's not allowed to use US dollars. But the point is, they're arguing that eventually Bitcoin will be scaled in, consolidated, and part of common practice. Like I said, the jury's out on that. I don't think it will be. And the evidence is fairly clear that central banks, when they're looking at an anti-fiat solution, they don't want digital gold that has no inherent properties. They want physical gold, which has physical properties from the periodic table of the elements, not a blockchain technology. It has natural scarcity. Bitcoin has, artificially created scarcity, which is one big of a big part of its appeal. I think central banks have been stacking physical gold at record levels and not Bitcoin for a reason. I think Bitcoin was created into a bubble for a reason to bail out some of America's debt. I don't think it's going to be used as a currency in a country like the US because it's an anti-dollar currency. But again, I don't make fun of Bitcoin investors and I don't claim to know the final direction of Bitcoin. I frankly don't give it a lot of attention. I can say I've seen a lot of Bitcoin millionaires, young and old, who have always come to my offices in Zurich and converted their Bitcoin to gold because they think it was a more true store of value, a medium of exchange in the future, and certainly in BRICS trade settlements and in central bank stacking, and as a true store of value because its volatility is far less. When I talk to these Bitcoin millionaires, they tell me under a drink and a soft breath that they always looked at Bitcoin as a speculation asset, not as a store of value. Those are the ones that I talk to. But that doesn't make them stupid or wrong. It doesn't mean I know where the final price of Bitcoin is going. My colleague, Egon von Greyer, says it can go to a million or it can go to zero. We don't know. And that's part of the problem. At least we don't know. And I don't think most people do. I don't think Michael Saylor knows. I think he's a salesman, not a fiduciary. That's my opinion. But I could be wrong. I really don't know. What I do know is that gold, whether you love it or hate it, whether you understand it or just coming to it, has been a store of value, has always gotten the last laugh over fiat money and broke governments, whether it was the Romans, whether it was the British Empire, the Dutch Empire, the Portuguese Empire, including the US Empire. They didn't disappear, but they rose and fall. And in every case, gold always became a monetary metal rather than just another commodity. And I think we're exactly in that cycle now. And I think the gold price is in its very first innings right now, not peak gold by any stretch.
So, when it comes to crisis hedge and inflation protection, I seem to be picking up that you like gold a lot more than Bitcoin. Would you verify that, or would you nuance that a bit? And then, secondly, we talked about how inflation is robbing the everyday man. So, where are
I
places
will.
you would recommend people parking money, or how would you invest in gold, or whatever you think would be a good place to protect ourselves?
I'll say that I personally would invest in gold, and I will say that people that I respect who are very smart here in Europe, Mark Friedrich is a German kind of fiat anti-fiat money, sound money advocate, is very positive on Bitcoin. Ronnie Sterfalo, who's the author of the In Gold We Trust report, who clearly shares the same opinions as I do on gold. Mark Friedrich and I have the same opinions on gold. They're much more objective and okay with Bitcoin. Like I said, I'm not a Peter Schiff or a Jim Rickards. I don't mock Bitcoin. I think if I had to recommend an asset, it really depends on what your profile is. Bitcoin can break a lot of hearts, but it has made a lot of people wealthy in this massive trend. Whether you think it's just a trend or you think it's a true anti-fiat solution to solve the dollar crisis down the road is a very personal decision. It's a debate. For me, gold is no debate at all. It doesn't have the alpha and the beta, excuse me, the beta moves that Bitcoin has. I think a lot of younger investors, I'm in my 50s. I'm not sexy anymore. I used to buy a lot of dot-com stocks and speculate. And I understand if I were young today, I would look to speculate to try and get some money because gold for me is a wealth preservation asset, a no-brainer. I don't have to worry about the store of value component of gold at all. You can debate with Bitcoin whether it is or one day will be. But I'm also someone who's in my mid-50s, not in my 30s. I'm not trying to create a lot of new wealth. I'm trying to protect what I've had decades to acquire. So it's a very different answer. I think of Bitcoin as a speculation asset right now. It could be an anti-fiat solution, but I don't blame younger investors who are just in such a horrifically poor system, in such an inflationary system, in such a dishonest system. They don't trust their government. They don't trust their central banks. They don't trust their dollar. And they're not able to preserve wealth with gold because they can't make wealth yet. So, of course, they're going to be attracted to Bitcoin. I can't blame them. Who am I to say that they're right or wrong? But I do think with high conviction that as a preservation asset, which is a lot more boring than a speculation asset, gold to me doesn't, I don't lose sleep on that. It really depends on where you are in your psychological profile, your investing profile. If I were to speculate, and I had the chance to buy gold, excuse me, Bitcoin at 1,000. I had a chance. And if I had bought it at 1,000, I would have sold it at 10,000. I would have never had the conviction to ride it this high. So when I see people who've really had that conviction and bought it at 1,000 and sold it 100 or 70 or 80, God bless them, because that takes a huge amount of conviction. I do worry that Bitcoin could break a lot of hearts because I've seen a lot of people get shaken out of that trade. So unless you have the conviction or unless you have the signals, which I'm not a trader in crypto or in meme coins, you got to be very careful is all I can say. But I don't think you're stupid for doing it. But I think it really addresses two very different profiles. I was a speculator in the dot-com bubble. I bought a lot of IPOs that behaved like Bitcoin in terms of the money I made on them. So I was just as lucky or stupid or smart as any Bitcoin investor was in the turn of the century. So I can't laugh at the speculation or the fundamentals of Bitcoin. I just don't trust it as a wealth preservation asset as much as I do gold. And that's where my mindset is today.
Matthew, you've written Rigged to Fail and co-authored Gold Matters. What led you to write those books, and what were you trying to get across?
Rigged to Fail, I wrote in, gosh, 2019. And I said, there's a bond crisis coming. This system is rigged to fail. It was talking about the Federal Reserve. It was talking about some of the themes you and I have talked about today, the unsustainability of our credit markets, the IOUs we were issuing, the disaster of money printing to solve that. And with, I think it came out in February of 2020 is when it came out. And then we had the biggest sell-off in the markets a month later in March of 2020 because of quote unquote COVID crisis. What I was not predicting the COVID crisis, but what the COVID crisis was wasn't a virus that caused the markets to crash. If you look at what the bond market did in March of 2020, it was what I was talking about in Rigged to Fail. It's an unsustainable bond market. What many people don't realize, whatever you think of the jab or no jab, Fauci, hero or absolute, I get into that rabbit hole. But what we saw in March of 2020 wasn't a COVID crisis, it was a bond crisis. And it was a bond crisis that needed to be bailed out to the same level that the 2008 financial crisis needed to be bailed out. We all know what happened in 2008. We know about TARP. We know about how Wall Street came to the rescue and bailed out the too big to fail banks. That if you were working at Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley, the very same year that you almost brought the entire financial system to its knees, you got the biggest bonuses of your life because you got bailed out. That created the March on Wall Street, the anxiety and the anger, totally understandable. The bailout that the too big to fail banks got in 2008 for what was a credit crisis was embarrassing to Wall Street and embarrassing to DC. Ironically, in Rigged to Fail, the bond market crisis of 2020 was even worse than 2008. And actually, the bailout by the Fed and the repo markets, which was even worse than 2008. Why that wasn't pitchforks in the streets and anti-Wall Street rhetoric was because it was hiding behind this crisis, this international global crisis with a fatality rate of less than 1%. Again, not mocking anyone who was very nervous during COVID and whether it was bat made or lab made, I'm not going to get into that debate. But behind that crisis language was a massive bailout for the bond market in 2020 and then some. And what Rigged to Fail was a warning just months before was a bond crisis. And there, I said there would be more crises in the banking system because there'd be more crises in the bond market. The bond market is the collateral. The US Treasury is the collateral for these banks. You fast forward to 2023, we had another major banking crisis at Signature Valley Bank, et cetera. And that wasn't a banking crisis. Again, it was a credit crisis. It was because bonds were falling in price, yields were rising, banks couldn't cover their collateral. So everything is a bond crisis. Very boring, but you have to understand the credit markets. So rigged to fail was really about the bond market, the Fed, and what really goes on behind the scenes of so-called free price discovery on Wall Street, of which I was a former hedge fund manager. I saw the tricks, the arbitrage. I tried to make that simple enough for other people to understand, so they could see how the sausage is made. When I wrote Gold Matters years later, that was the reaction to the bond crisis, because a bond crisis is a liquidity crisis. And when you run out of liquidity or money, you need to create more. When you create more, you debase it. And when you debase something, that ruins it. So you need an anti-fiat, anti-debasement trade. And to me, the next 20 years was clearly gold. And commodities in general, precious metals in particular, and gold specifically. So I went from trying to educate on risk assets to now precious metals and commodities. And like many, I think we're heading into a hard asset super cycle. I think that's the safer trade, the direction of the hockey puck going forward. So I wrote Gold Matters to give that opinion to readers as kind of a bookend to Rigged to Fail.
Matthew, you were a former hedge fund manager. You've written books. You're now a partner at Von Grayers Gold. What is that about, and how do people find you? I know you're in Zurich, Switzerland, but how do people reach out to you or find you and benefit from what you do?
Yeah, Von Grayers is the world's largest private gold vault for high net worth investors outside of the banking system. So we believe that if you're going to own physical gold at a meaningful level, it should never be held in a commercial bank for numerous reasons of counterparty risk, illegality, and failure to serve. It needs to be in a jurisdiction where gold is a protected asset. So for us, that's Switzerland and Singapore. They're massive gold hubs. It needs to have a legal firewall between the storage of your gold and the government that where you live. So we have a lot of clients from the US. You need to have the ability to convert that money, that gold, into fiat money when you need it. You save in gold and you spend in fiat, because if you save in gold, you're savings is protected, but when you need to live in the real world, you convert it to fiat money. So we have a trading desk that provides liquidity. We're fully insured, and it means also fully segregated, allocated gold. You're not commingling, you're not putting in an account in some bank. The gold bar is in your name and your name only. It's 100% yours. You can have total audit access to it 24/7, and it's in the safest Swiss bedrock vault in the world. So it's a very unique service. And we do logistics. We can move gold anywhere in the world, from Nebraska to Australia to South America. But so it's an incredibly high-end service. It's a high minimum, so it's not for everyone. But all the articles and interviews and conversations and all the information on the website is free to anyone. And I know that 99.9% of the people I'm talking to can't afford Swiss gold storage in a private vault. And I respect that. But they can all get informed about gold, and whether you're buying a couple grams or an ounce a year or a quarter, a lot of the information we have is really important to give you the conviction to do that. If you're trying to get rich overnight, gold's not the play. If you're trying to preserve your wealth and avoid getting robbed by your government, gold is a serious allocation, though. Whether you make millions or just a few hundred dollars a month, you got to think about how to protect your money. And our clients from over 90 countries get that pretty well.
We'll be putting Von Grayers Gold and the information in the links in the show notes. Please check that out. Matthew, thank you for
Thank you.
informing me. Everybody, I'm just Steve Yang, learning alongside you from informed, interesting, intelligent people like Matthew Pippenberg. Everyone stay smart, curious, and disciplined. Thanks, Matthew, so much for
Yes.
being here.
Thank you, Steve. It was a real pleasure.